Good morning, everyone. We're convening today's Revenue Committee meeting. We have a couple of things on our agenda today. First and foremost, our favorite subject, the estate tax. Without further ado, I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2541. Mazin, do you want to kind of set the table here, and then we'll have the Law Commission come up and talk about... here comes the co-chair who actually has the gavel. I'm filling.
Where are we?
We have opened a work session on the estate tax bill, and Mazin's about to tell us about it.
Co-chair.
Wonderful.
Members of the committee, the House Bill 2541 as it stands now, is the skeleton, if you will, that holds the attempt to work into this into the law, the new reform that you've sent to the Law Commission in 2009 session, and today we come back to a full circle. The Law Commission on March 28th kind of got the final word on the product and the work that has taken a long span of the last year and a half or so. And today they bring it to you in the report that you have in front of you. The product of the legal language in the Dash 5 amendment to the Bill 2541. This would be today brought to you primarily and officially by the Oregon Law Commission, the Chair, Lynn Shutterly, and the Executive Director, Jeff Dobbins, and also Deputy Director Wendy Johnson. They're all here, three of them, and they would be going through the report and giving you the final result recommendations on the output of this work group that they've worked for this whole interim.
Thank you. And I see the Commission is here. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yet again, you've provided us with another fat bill.
Yes.
And we appreciate it.
Good morning, co-chairs, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Lane Shetterly, appearing before you again today on House Bill 2541 as chair of the Oregon Law Commission and chair of the Inheritance Tax Work Group. I am pleased to say that last Monday the full Oregon Law Commission reviewed and took action to approve the Dash 5 amendments that you have before you today. So these come now with the stamp of approval and endorsement of the Commission. And so rather than just reporting to you today, we're actually here to present these to you for deliberation in work session. I will just make a few introductory comments this morning, then I will turn this over to our Deputy Director, Wendy Johnson, and Executive Director Jeff Dobbins to take you through a little bit more detail. Of course, I'll be happy to answer questions and as we go. I should also mention, Mr. Chair, Madam Co-Chair, that we do have members of the work group who are in attendance at the meeting today, and it's certainly up to you if you wanted to call any of them forward. I know we're not in a public hearing, but some of them may have insightful comments to make as well. But I'll leave that to you after we've had a chance to go through. Our review. Just very...
If I may,
yes.
Lane, it was not our intention to work the bill today.
Oh.
We do plan to treat this as a quasi-public hearing, at least, so we can review the content of the material. And if you think it's appropriate to bring other people up, then please let us know that.
Thank you. I think that'd be fine when we get done. We'll try and leave enough time for that. We've had members that have put in every bit as much time as we have, and have great expertise themselves, greater than mine, in this subject matter area. And I think it'd be useful for the committee to hear from them probably after we've had a chance to go through the overview. Just very briefly, what you have before you, you have the -5 amendments, which replace the bill. So this is what we will be dealing with today. You also have the inheritance tax work group report. For those of you who have not worked with the Law Commission before, one of our signature products with every bill that we put forward is an official report. This report has been approved by the Commission just as the bill has been approved. And we have the courts now fairly in line with us. We've had a number of cases where the appellate courts have had occasion to interpret a Law Commission bill, and the courts have taken to looking at the report as legislative history and legislative intent. And so this report is also a very important document for you, and we take great care in how we prepare it. So it explains the bill and does become will become a significant piece of legislative history on the bill as it moves forward. Just in very broad construct, what we have here, as you requested, is a bill that will create a standalone Oregon estate tax, and we'll begin today, I think, to start changing our terminology. This bill creates an estate tax that has a relationship to the federal estate tax, very much like our state income tax has a relationship to the federal income tax. We refer to the federal estate tax for definitional purposes and for larger structural components, but then we have our own Oregon oddities where we depart from the federal law. Significantly, in this -5 amendment, we have where the federal law has a $5 million exemption amount. Oregon law currently has $1 million exclusion, exemption, I should say, and this bill moves us to a $1.5 million exemption. So there is a difference between Oregon and federal law. We also have, as I have explained before, where we have currently, once you get over that threshold, the estate is taxed back to the first dollar, so that you go from zero tax to $33,000 in tax once you cross that threshold of $1 million of taxable estate. We have ameliorated that by creating a ramp based on rates that begin at the taxable level of $1.5 million. The effect of that is to relieve smaller estates of tax from tax. The trade-off of that is that on the larger end, larger estates will pay somewhat more in tax for the purpose of keeping the whole system revenue neutral in large measure. And then we have adjusted the natural resource tax credit to fit within this new construct by creating a formula for calculating the credit. We've been explicit about marital property and its relationship, how we deal with that in the Oregon estate tax relative to natural resources tax credit and also relative to federal law. And I think the last thing I'll say, and then turn it over to Wendy for a little bit more detailed walkthrough, is on this issue of revenue neutrality. We believe that, first of all, this is not a revenue-raising measure. This is not an intent to increase revenue by amending the Oregon estate tax. We recognize that the estate tax is a volatile revenue producer. We've used roughly $200 million per biennium as the benchmark for the the estate tax. But of course, in any given year, based on the changes that this bill proposes, if you have a preponderance of smaller estates, there will be less revenue. If you have a preponderance of very large estates, there may be more revenue from biennium to biennium, year to year. But that's just based on the serendipity of what estates may be coming through in any given time. We believe that the trade-offs we have made between smaller estates and larger estates and taking into account the natural resources tax credit, that this is substantially revenue neutral in its approach over the long term to the estate tax. Again, recognizing that any given year you can have a mix of estates that might raise more or less based on this dash 5 construct than what we would have under current law. So with those brief comments, I think I'll turn it over to Wendy to take you through a little bit more detail some of the policy provisions of the measure, and then Jeff Dobbins has some eye-glazing charts for you, and then we'll take it from there.
Good morning, Co-Chair Barnhart and Co-Chair Berger, Wendy Johnson, Deputy Director and General Counsel for the Law Commission. You should have before you the Dash 5s and the Law Commission report, and I'm going to work through the report starting on page 7. In that section, starting on 7 to page 17, we've listed all the policy changes that the bill makes. As you know, it's a long bill, over 40 pages. I'm not going to go through each section, but I want to highlight where we think we've made a policy change that you should be aware of, and I'll explain where it is in the bill, so for questions we can dialogue as we go. So starting on page 7, as Lane explained, one of the first things the commission and the work group agreed to do was update the tie-in to the Federal Internal Revenue Code. So on page 2 of the bill, the Dash 5s, it's on line 24. You see that anytime we're referring to the Internal Revenue Code, we're talking now about the December 31st, 2010 Internal Revenue Code rather than the 2000. So again, if you're following along, it's on page 2, line 24. If you look just a few lines above, you'll see on line 6, the Oregon taxable estate means the federal taxable estate with the adjustments that are in section 3, starting on page 3, line 17. So we're constantly referring to the Internal Revenue Code. The federal taxable estate is on page 1 of the amendments. That's referring to the Internal Revenue Code that will now be tied to 2010 rather than 2000. So these definitions at the very beginning set up the rest of the bill. And it's important for practitioners and the public and the department as well to be tied to our newer code. So we started with that premise of wanting to be more up-to-date, and it worked this way because Congress did pass in the very end of December the new estate tax for the federal tax, federal estate tax. And so we're going to be as current as we can, and it actually works well to have this new date to 2010. Now, if you look on page 3 of the bill, starting on line 17, you see that it says the Oregon taxable estate to be used for the purpose of computing the tax shall be the federal taxable estate, and then on line 19, increase by, and then on line 30, reduce by. This is the new basic formula of how you figure out what your Oregon taxable estate is. You take your federal and you add these increases, which are basically tax deductions that you got on your federal return, and then lines 23 to 29 have to do with the marital property issues that you add back those if there is value on still remaining on the second, on the surviving spouse's death. You add in some of those in that data, and then you reduce it by, on page 4, I guess I mixed up the marital. You reduce it by the value on the second spouse, and you increase it. And then on line 3 is the $1.5 million. You're reducing all estates by $1.5 million as the new exclusion. Oregon has had a $1 million threshold. This is a $1.5 million exclusion. And I think we've talked to you before about why we wanted to increase it to $1.5 million, the variety of reasons. We haven't increased it since for over five years. And if you look on, let's see, page 22 of the bill, you'll see where we have been over the years with this threshold.
And you're referring to the dash fives?
Correct.
Yeah, thank you.
So if you look on page 22, you'll see that back in 87, we were tied to the federal threshold. And then in line seven, you'll see that in 2004, the threshold was 700,000. Excuse me, 2003, it was 700,000. 2004, it was 850. 2005, it was 950. 2006, a million. And then we haven't increased it since 2006. So this would increase it to 1.5 million. And that happens on page four. Then if you look just a few lines down, starting on lines 5 all the way to lines 22, you'll see that once you've figured out what your taxable estate with your increases and decreases, there's an actual schedule that starts on lines 11 going through lines 22. In column 3 is the base tax, and then if you're over that column 1 amount, then it's the percent. And so you'll see it's progressive, starting at 8.6, going up to 19.6 as the tax rates. So for the first time since, I think it's been since the 80s, there will be an actual schedule that you can figure out what your tax rate is going to be in your actual tax bill by looking at the Oregon statutes. The numbers that are in these columns came from your legislative revenue office to make it revenue neutral. I would note that that data did come from about 15 months ago, so we're not sure exactly where those numbers would be today, but it's increments of about $1 million until you get to the higher end, and then it does increase, but the increments are bigger. But it is a progressive rate that's comparable to Washington. You'll notice that it ends up being a little bit of a lower tax rate on the smaller estates and a little bit higher on the larger estates than present law, but reminding the committee again that for those over $5 million that have a federal estate tax return to file, they'll be getting a deduction on their federal return for their state taxes paid. So, in effect, the federal government ends up helping to pay Oregon's tax. It used to be about 45 cents on the dollar, but that's until December when Congress lowered the tax rate to 35%. So now it's about 35 cents on the dollar that those estates over $5 million will be getting a credit on their federal return, or a deduction, rather. So that takes us through on the report, page 7, both 1 and 2, explaining the tie-in, the threshold, and the tax rate. On page 8 of the report, I've explained the ramp. That's not really obvious in existing law because we're tied to the federal estate tax, the state tax credit to figure out our Oregon tax rate. It's tied to that credit. And if you look at that credit on the federal books, it just starts taxing from dollar one if you're over the threshold. And so on the schedule on page 4 of the dash fives, it's including that exclusion. So it no longer has that going back to dollar one. It's just those dollars over the 1.5 because you've reduced that from your taxable estate. So the ramp is in there, but there's not really a good site for that. But it is no longer this cliff. It's a ramp. Moving on to number 3, marital property. There's really not a change in existing law because administrative rule already provided that you could make separate elections for state marital property and federal marital property. In Oregon, we call it special marital property. But it was an administrative rule, and this bill actually codifies that rule and makes it clear that, yes, you can make separate elections for federal and state purposes. And that's on page 6, lines 1 and 2 of the bill. And then, as I explained in section 3, it has the add-backs and reductions to deal with that Oregon special marital property as well. Then moving on to number 4, that's intangible property. The basic rule that this bill would provide is that non-residents would no longer be taxed on intangibles. Residents would continue to be taxed on intangibles. All residents and non-residents who have real property or personal property in Oregon would be taxed. The basic theory is if your property is in Oregon, we tax it on the estate tax. The problem is with intangibles, for non-residents, it's sort of the point of an intangible is you're not really sure where it doesn't exist. It's intangible. You can't touch it. So trying to define that it is an organ, we started out kind of wanting to keep that concept, but it just really was not possible to try to figure out how to tax non-residents on intangibles. And on the top of page 9, you'll see the reasons why we decided not to continue taxing non-residents on intangibles. It was too complex, and it didn't provide a lot of revenue to the state presently. Anyway, it's nearly impossible to enforce because it's often part of an LLC or part of some stock or something that it's got a tentacle in Oregon, but the amount of touching to Oregon on that intangible, we just couldn't come up with a line that worked. No other state on the West Coast or even from Mississippi over really tried to do that anymore, and so we did delete that. To accomplish that, you'll see that on the early sections of the bill on page 5. You'll see the references to intangible property are deleted. There is one exception, even for residents. If another state does try to tax our residents on their intangibles, as I said, there are a few states that try to do that anymore, but if they would be taxed, say they have Hawaii, for example, is bringing back their estate tax. If Hawaii taxed an Oregon resident on their intangible, we would provide an exception for taxing our residents, so there wouldn't be a double taxation. Real property and personal property constitutionally can only be taxed in one state. Intangible property, there's not that appellate decision that says that yet. There then runs at that issue, but again, it's complex, and so it is possible to be taxed on your intangible property in more than one state, and so there is an exception on the top of page 5 that takes out intangible property from the numerator for our residents as well.
If it's subject to tax in
another state. Yeah, exactly. I feel like I'm speeding through. So
you excluded intangibles for non-residents, and if a resident's intangibles are taxed somewhere else,
right,
then you exclude that portion as well.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, that's correct.
Okay, thanks. I got it.
So those are some of the easier parts of the bill. Now we're going to move on to natural resource property. Natural resource property in the report goes from pages 9 all the way through.
If you have questions.
Please, yes. Representative Brewer.
Thank you. I just have some questions that I've been jotting down as we've been going along. I've got a series, if you
please,
mind.
Go ahead.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Indulge me. So what it seems like we're doing a little bit of a shift here where we're assuming again then, even for these estates up to a $1.5 million value, that in effect we're adopting in general most of the at least reporting issues and methodologies of the federal estate tax. We're creating a parallel Oregon estate tax essentially rather than just a pickup or what we're doing now. And so the $1.5 million, as a matter of conversation, one of the things we have is the federal government goes around and moves the exemption up or down or whatever. Was there a discussion at all about indexing the $1.5 million up or down or tying it into any ratio with the federal government at all? Was there any discussion about that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Brewer, no, I don't recall that there was. I think there might be a delegation issue if we just tie it to changes in federal law. But what this bill does do, and again, much like our income tax now, we're connecting to a date, and when federal changes occur, it really will require the state to look at those changes to make decisions whether to connect or reconnect, basically, to those federal estate tax law changes. So going forward, while changes won't be automatic, any changes in the federal law would be the subject matter, I think, of discussion in the legislature as to, just as you do in the income tax law now, whether we want to make any changes based on federal changes in federal law. I think that's probably the best answer.
Okay. And then talking about non-residency and real property, Section 3.2b of this I just want to understand the real property located, and we talked a little bit about intangibles in the formula. I want to make sure that I understand with real property for non-residents that we are still respecting or have we changed anything on ownership of real estate through some type of pass-through entity, LLC or something like that? Are we including or excluding real property owned by another, or are we looking at, say, the LLC interest or partnership interest?
Mr. Chairman and Co-Chair Representative Brewer, an interest in an LLC is an intangible. And so if property is held in an LLC by an out-of-state resident, by a non-resident, then that intangible, that LLC interest, would not be taxed.
Okay. And we're respecting the current policy that we have.
Well, yeah, I think so, because I think what we found, and frankly, it's not perfectly clear just what we do right now, but what we
that's the problem.
Thank you.
Yeah, what we found is that and Deborah Buchanan from the department is here, and I think she can back me up on this. We're just not getting any estate tax off of intangibles of non-residents anyway. And so I think really what this is doing, as much as anything, is clarifying that this is the law. We did talk about, you know, ways to do that, and Wendy mentioned that, but it becomes devilishly difficult. For instance, if you're a resident of California and you own stock in Nike, is Nike an Oregon corporation? I think it is.
Mr. Chair, it is.
you have an intangible that owns stock of an Oregon corporation. Are we going to try and tax that, you know, if a California resident dies owning Nike stock? It's publicly traded. Conceptually, that's the same thing if you own an office building or a, you know, vacation home you and some friends have gotten together and you formed an LLC to buy this vacation home. That still is an intangible interest. And it became really impossible as we tried to look at ways to create the dividing line between what we're going to tax and what we wouldn't tax. No, we're not going to tax a non-resident's holdings in Nike stock that's traded publicly. How do we create a principal distinction between that and interest in an LLC? And I'll say we spent probably 3 or 4 meetings going around on that and finally came back to the point that, well, we're really not collecting any tax on those anyway. Why go through the effort to create this? And also enforceability would be extremely difficult where you've got a non-resident. How do they know they're supposed to file? How do we know that they've died? So in terms of compliance and enforceability, we just got to talk ourselves right into the exception.
Especially when that Nike stock is held in street name in a brokerage firm.
Sure.
That's right. Okay, I appreciate that. I just wanted to make sure that we were respecting the non-resident ownership structure of real property here. Now, you talked a little bit about this, but the states that have multi-state property, the formula, just so I understand, for residents and non-residents, just so I understand, we talked a little bit about it. For residents, I just want to make sure I understand this. We're basically looking at their total estate, and then they're taxable in Oregon on everything except for we're removing from the numerator of the allocation formula, apportionment formula, rather not allocation, we're removing from it any intangible property that is subject to tax by another state. But outside of that, if they didn't have any, they'd be at 100%, regardless of property outside of the state. For non-residents, the formula is, again, basically walk me through it. Is there still their full estate, do you have a formula for non-residents, or is their actual return, their base, actually different?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Brewer, actually, even on the resident estate, we only tax real property and personal property located in Oregon, okay, and then all intangibles, unless the intangible was taxed somewhere else.
So we're taking a modification out of the excluded property, and then of the remaining, then we're looking at a formula.
Representative Barnhart, Representative Brewer, I'm not sure I quite understand. It's on page 4, starting on lines 23, and then going on to the top of page 5. Once you've figured out your tax based on the whole estate, then we take it times a ratio, and the numerator is property, real property and personal property in Oregon, and intangible property anywhere, unless, but we do take out intangible property if it was taxed somewhere else. So basically, we're just taxing everything that's in Oregon. And then the denominator is the whole estate. So if almost everything is from Oregon on that resident, you know, it could be 80% or something. But if there's a piece of property in Hawaii, we're taking that out, and it would be multiplied. That would be on the – we take it out of the numerator. So if the tax was $1 million, then if we took out 20%, you know, it would be $800,000 because of that Hawaii property, because that real property would be taxed in Hawaii.
Maybe I need to look at the language a bit more. I'm confused as to getting to the taxable base versus a taxable apportionment formula. I'm hearing a couple different things, and I want to make sure I understand the two. Can you tell me whether they're resident, if they're resident, how do we get to their taxable base, and if they're non-resident, how do we get to their taxable base, and then maybe we can talk about the formula, because I think I understand the formula.
Chair Barnhart, represented by Brewer, what we're missing is to figure out the base for everyone, it's the whole federal estate.
Okay, that's what I thought.
And so if you've got a huge estate, even if it's in multiple states, you're going to get taxed at a higher tax rate than somebody with a smaller estate, even though it may be a small estate in Oregon, a small Oregon taxable estate. But the way you get the deduction is when you go through sub 5 and sub 6 on page 4 and 5. Sub 5 is for the resident, and sub 6 is for the non-resident.
Gotcha. Okay, so as we still get to the same taxable base. So once that taxable base hits the $1.5 million, they have they're subject to it and have a reporting requirement. And then we go through and we calculate the tax, but the formula is differing based on residency. Okay. Just wanted to make sure I was hearing a couple different things.
Thank you. I appreciate that series of questions because you just answered one of the ones I had.
I'm happy to do that for you, Chair.
Yes.
Okay. So now on page 3, I only have two more questions, but I don't promise that I'm not going to come up with more. But for this section, before you get into the nuances later on, I'll develop more, I'm certain. On page 3, we talk about federal taxable estate and we talk about the down on line 18, starts at 17. Oregon taxable estate to be used for purposes of computing the tax imposed under this section shall be the federal taxable estate. And so I just want to make sure that that is not a definitional issue, and maybe it's already currently used and I just haven't been sensitive to it. Is that problematic if the federal estate is not taxable?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Brewer, it's not, because there are other sections of the bill that make it clear that whether or not you have a federal liability or not, you're still going to owe Oregon estate tax if you have an estate larger than $1.5 million.
Can you show me where federal taxable estate is otherwise defined?
Yeah, it's page 1 and at the bottom of the page and the top of page 2.
Right, so it's on the bottom of, it's starting on line 22 on page 1.
One of the things I asked for, which I don't think we've received yet, is the relevant federal Internal Revenue Code laws, so we can see how they make this definition for us.
This definition focuses more on the transfer of property, not so much the numbers. So it doesn't have that issue about they have different thresholds. So it's the transfer of property that kicks in to determine what the taxable estate is.
Okay, it's still, maybe the federal is still trying, and I'm getting a note to that I'm in the weeds, but I also noticed...
If I could just interrupt just quickly. Colleagues, I think it's really important that you parse through page 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, and that's what Representative Brewer is doing right now in order to understand this thing. I went through it the other day, and it took me quite a while just to figure out how these pieces fit together. I think they do, mm-hmm. but they it do. Wasn't easy.
Right.
Yeah, please go ahead.
No, and I have one last question. I know that they seem like they're in the weeds, but they're kind of foundational for where we're going, because we do have language shifts, and language is different. And my last question at this point talks about the replacement of beneficiary with permissible distributee. And I wasn't sure. I see that it's defined in a different section, but I'm wondering if you can tell me the thoughts on that, the meaning behind it, and why the terminology shift.
Mr. Chair, Representative Brewer, unless we... oh, you have that in the report. That comes out of... it was a reference out of the...
tax code.
Yeah, and it's on page 19 of the report. There, that was very intentional. And in fact, Jeff Sheen is with us in the room today, as I recall. He was the one who caught that as a necessary amendment and may be best suited to answer that in detail beyond how it's described in the report.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Brewer, I believe it's because distributees suggest more of a trust issue, and that's not always the interest involved. It could be real property or something else. And so I think distribution would seem to focus only on something from a trust, and permissible distribute would could include other property. But I'll leave that to Jeff Sheen to go into more detail. It's a,
I appreciate that.
An estate planning issue that I'm not to speed on.
Versus benefit. I appreciate that. Thank you so much. I can be done for now.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative. And we left off starting a new thought.
Natural resource property.
Ah, yes.
Our favorite topic.
It is interesting how the small pieces sometimes take more room than the big pieces do.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Brewer, the definitions are tricky to go through, federal estate, gross estate, Oregon taxable estate, and I would also direct your attention to the section-by-section analysis starting on page 18. Section 1 kind of explains those definitions on page 18 of the report. But moving on to natural resource property, that starts on page 12 of the dash 5s. And so what you see for the first couple of pages is all italicized, which means we're deleting the first couple of pages of the existing natural resource credit law. And then you see on page 14 the new bold language and a new set of definitions.
Oh, okay.
So if you're looking on the report, we're starting on page 9, and if you're looking at the dash 5s, it's page 14. I want to highlight a couple of new definitions. On line 23 of page 14, you'll see farm business and many paragraphs underneath that. And then on page 15, line 7, you'll see fishing business defined. And then on line 10, you'll see forestry business defined. So these are new terms, farm business, fishing business, and forestry business. We're using the same concepts from your existing natural resource credit law, but we're defining it as a business that does those things.
Do we think that this definition is inclusive?
Chair Barnhart,
we've got all the pieces?
Yeah.
Yes, we believe this captures what the types of businesses you are wanting to protect, but there was no definition of such of each of those businesses. Instead, it was focused more on natural resource property defined, but natural resource property, that definition in existing law was really only real property. But then the natural resource property sections provided a credit for real property and personal property and working capital. Then the way this is revised is natural resource property includes real property, personal property, and what we're calling operating allowance, which is like working capital in terms of its cash. So we're calling all of those things natural resource property if they're part of one of these three businesses. So we're able to use the term natural resource property then throughout the rest of the sections to capture all these things under these businesses. That also allows us to restrict the use of those properties for the 5 years that you have in existing laws, but to cover all of them instead of presently it only seems to cover real property. It's used for the look back and such. So these terms are key for some of the other sections I'll be explaining.
And, Mr. Chair, if I may, probably the most problematic definition was farm business. Fishing business is pretty straightforward. Forestry business is pretty straightforward. But we did have substantial discussion, too, about what is a farm business. You know, have you listed everything here? And where we came down, our comfort level is in it's on line 5, page 15, raising other agricultural or horticultural products. So we haven't captured every possible agricultural and farm activity in A through G. We think we've captured that in H. So it's a broad definition, but it has to be engaged. It is a business operated for the purpose of obtaining a profit and money. So that's what we're really focusing on in terms of the use of this qualified property.
So, Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, just to reiterate, we're not really changing what the credit is applicable to. It still covers real property, personal property, and cash. It's just we're changing the definition so they work and work better together as we go through the rest of the bill. So the other definition, of course, is natural resource property, and it starts on line 15 of page 15. And so you'll see on line 19 that it includes, well, actually going back to line, I'll just read you the definition. Natural resource property means the following property. If on the date of the decedent's death, the property is owned by the decedent and used in the operation of a farm business, forestry business, or fishing business owned by the decedent. And then we list real property on line 19, the timber and trees, the crops, all these different types of personal property, livestock and nursery stock, and then all the fishing. So fishing is even included in the definition too, so we're not having to track farms, forests, and fish separately. We can just use natural resource property throughout because we've covered them all there. And then on line 6, on page 16, you'll see operating allowance is also included in the definition of natural resource property. Because I said under existing law, which uses the term working capital, you could get a credit for working capital, but then we didn't carry through that working capital under the definition of natural resource property, so we couldn't restrict it, replace it, and all those types of things. So we're including it all under the definition of what you can claim a credit for, but tying it to the definition. And then there is a catch-all on line 7 of any other tangible and intangible personal property that was used in the operation of the farm business in case we missed some part of the personal property. We tried to be as specific as we can, but also inclusive. But when you're trying to list, you know, crops, for example, we weren't sure if that covered fruits or not, so we looked at Washington, and they use crop and fruit, because berries aren't always considered crops, or trees, you know, the fruit trees weren't, so we tried to catch them all, but in case we missed, the definitional catch-all is there. So that gets us now to, once you've said, oh, you've got to have one of these businesses, that's the property in that business that you can claim a credit on, what is the credit actually going to be? On page 16, line 17, it provides an estate shall be allowed a credit for the value of natural resource property claimed. So that's the, you get a credit. Then the next lines, any operating allowance claimed may not exceed the lesser of $1.5 million or 20% of the total value of the natural resource property claimed. So this is just restricting what you can claim as operating allowance at that 20% or $1.5 million. And we've talked about why we landed there, and the report explains it, but I can answer more questions there. But then on line 22 to 27, okay, we said you get a credit, your operating allowance included in there can't be over $1.5 million or 20%, then we still are not giving you a dollar per dollar exactly. It's the credit allowed shall be computed by multiplying the tax, going back to that new tax schedule and the rates. You multiply that tax that you've computed, and you multiply it by a ratio, the numerator of which is an amount equal to the natural resource property claimed, but maxing out at $6 million. You can't claim more than $6 million with the natural resource property, and the denominator is the adjusted gross estate. So we're taking the tax owed times the ratio of how much natural resource property you're claiming. So I can go through the requirements to even qualify, but for example, one of them is that you have to have 50% natural resource property. So this is not even going to be allowed for estates that don't have that much natural resource property. But if they do have at least 50%, then their tax is going to be a ratio. It's going to be lessened by how much they have. So if they have a lot of natural resource property, their tax is going to go down significantly. If they don't have very much, it's that ratio will be smaller. And I have...
Representative Berger.
Yeah.
I get this, but I'm wondering, Mazen, or if you have any, you know, theoretical examples.
And
no.
Perfect transition.
Okay.
Jeff is here.
Jeff, you have a theoretical example of
this. There we go. Co-chairs Barnhart and Berger, Jeff Dobbins, executive director of the Law Commission. And, in fact, I have a chart which we handed out to you this morning, and it's got two sides to it. One side has got a number of different columns listing various different hypothetical estates letter to A through T. The back side of this document is actually has information that explains a little bit about not only the current amounts raised and the current size of estates that have been filed for the under existing law, but also some descriptions about what the size of the estates have been that have been claiming natural resource properties over the past three full tax years or so. But to go directly, Co-Chair Berger, to your question with respect to the hypothetical estates, if you start on this page that has the listing of estates, these are really intended to be illustrative. These ignore any of the complications that Representative Brewer was pointing out with intangibles. And if you're a resident or non-resident, this just assumes that your entire gross estate for an Oregon resident is all located in Oregon and taxable in Oregon. And what this does is it lays out a number of hypothetical estates ranging in size from $1.6 million, you see the line that says gross estate, all the way down to a $40 million gross estate size under estate T. To start out, just to ignore the effects of natural resource credit, if you look at the lines in black, and so, for instance, under estate A, the gross estate size is $1.6 million. The current tax, no NRC, assuming there's no natural resource credit applied, would be $70,800. And under the Dash 5 amendments, the total tax would be $8,600. Now, you can see that that's a very substantial reduction, and that's the result of two different effects that that Wendy and Lane have already talked about, which is, number one, and primarily the fact that you're not being taxed under the Dash 5s on $1.6 million. You're only being taxed on the amount over $1.5 million. And so as a practical matter, what that is an 8.6% tax on $100,000. That's all that is.
Got it.
And then as you work your way up the list, you see how the numbers continue to increase. And again, we're still focusing solely on the numbers in black, which ignore the effect of natural resource credits. And so if you take, for instance, the last estate in that column, Estate J, a $3 million gross estate, current tax $182,000, the Dash 5s would be $132,500. Now, you do notice that, as Wendy and Lane had pointed out, that at some point in time, because we are no longer taxing $1.5 million in these smaller estates, to maintain revenue neutrality, the tax rates have to come up a little bit. And at some point in time, once you get to a larger estate size, the total tax that would be paid by estates is going to become larger under the Dash 5s than under existing law. And you can see that happen in the shift from estates N to estate O. Estate N is a $5 million gross estate. Estate O is a $7 million gross estate. And you can see under estate N, the Dash 5s, you were paying less taxes than current tax. And under estate O, you would be paying a little bit more. And from there, that number continues to increase. And so those larger estates would pay a larger amount in the base tax rate. So are there any questions on the way that base estate, the tax rate, works? Okay. So then we come to the natural resources credit, and I think this goes
to just a moment. Yes, sure. That's not counting the amount that the feds allow us.
Right. That's correct, yes, absolutely.
All
in
right.
fact, it's worth noting, and as a point that I was going to make, and thank you for pointing that out, Coach R. Barnhart, that one of the nice things about the way that this change happens is that just as the Dash 5 tax amount starts to become a little bit bigger than what would be true under current law, the offset with respect to the federal system starts to kick in. And so in some ways, the federal government is helping to pay for a portion of that increase.
And again, if I may, Mr. Chair, just a reminder on the tax rates. We were cognizant, of course, that we were going to be increasing tax on the larger estates in order to maintain revenue neutrality with the reductions for the lower estates. That's where we took a peek across the river to see what our friends up north were doing with their estate tax, wanting to keep our tax rates in line with theirs so that we didn't create an anti-competitive environment between Oregon and Washington, and our rates are in fact in line with the upper rates of Washington. So it's an increase, but it's not an increase relative to our neighbor to the north, and as to our neighbors to the east and south, they don't have an estate tax anyway, so there's really no comparison there. But we did look at Washington as we structured this to make sure that we were not getting out of line with the neighborhood and when we are in line.
Okay. The other effect that that then is worth pointing out here is just the way that you go about calculating the natural resource property credit on these estates. And for each of the estate sizes, we've tried to provide you with a range of different options. The first thing to note is, just as Wendy had pointed out, that you're not eligible to get a credit for natural resource property if at least 50% of your property is not a natural resources property. Now, that doesn't mean you have to claim all of the property for purposes of the credit, because as Wendy will explain, it imposes additional obligations on the property that you claim for purposes of getting the credit. So there are some numbers here where the amount of property that you're claiming in natural resources may be less than the total amount that you have in your estate as a practical matter. The other thing that's worth pointing out is that once you go over a $15 million gross estate, natural resource property credit is not available. And that's also that's true under current law as well. And so you see for the estates S&T at $20 million and $40 million gross size, they just aren't eligible to claim natural resource property credit. And so the tax is what the tax is. For purposes of the estates that are less than $15 million, however, what this attempts to do is, again, to demonstrate the effect of existing law versus the Dash 5 proposals. The first thing to note is that, as Wendy just explained, the way that the credit works under the Dash 5s is you basically get a credit for the proportion of the estate that you are claiming in natural resources property. So if you claim an amount of natural resource property that's 50% of your estate, you get a 50% tax credit. If you claim a 75% of your estate in natural resources property, you get a 75% tax credit. And if, in fact, the entire estate that you have is all in natural resources property, you would get a 100% tax credit. And so you can see that last point reflected in estates C, F, and L, all of which are claiming 100% of their gross estate in natural resource properties, and none of which would pay taxes, either under current law or under the Dash 5 proposal. With respect to estates that are claiming a smaller amount, you can see, for instance, estate A, which is a $1.6 million gross estate, claiming $800,000 in natural resource property. The effect of the current natural resource credit would be to give you a $22,800 credit, bringing you down to having to pay only $48,000 in tax. It's even better under the Dash 5s in the sense that you get a 50% credit and you'd only have to pay $4,300 in tax. The two significant differences between the way that the calculation is done under the Dash 5s and the way that it happens under existing law is, number one, because it's a ratio under the Dash 5s, the amount of credit does continue to increase, even as you get into the larger estates, because the amount of tax that's being paid is increasing. And so even if you're still only claiming 43% of your property in natural, or 43% of your estate in natural resources property, and I'm looking, for instance, at estate O, the amount of credit that you are getting is continuing to go up because it's simply a ratio of the total tax that you are paying. And so that does continue to increase. The other effect is that as a result of that, in contrast to existing law, while there is a $6 million cap under the Dash 5 proposal, it doesn't mean that the total amount of credit stops going up. That again, continues to increase as the estate size goes up to $15 million, depending on the amount of natural resource property, on the ratio of natural resource property that's being claimed. Once you hit the $6 million number under the Dash 5s, that amount starts to flatten out to some degree, and so it's not going up at quite the same rate. But hopefully what this does is it illustrates for the committee just some hypotheticals, and I guess at this point in time, then, I'd invite any other questions that may come up.
But before he does, if I may, the issue, too, that we said we were striving for revenue neutrality not only in total in the bill but also maintaining consistent share within the natural resources tax credit. And, Jeff, you've done the numbers on that based on states filed.
Yeah, and this is actually the other side, the reverse side of the sheet that you're looking at now will sort of help illustrate this to some degree. One of the things that's worth noting is at least for the years where we had information with respect to natural resource property claims, the sizes were actually quite low. We didn't have a lot of very large estates claiming very large amounts of natural resource properties. In fact, we only had one estate, as best we could tell, that was claiming, or I guess two estates claiming natural resource property amounts over $3 million. The differences between the way existing law calculates the numbers and the way the Dash 5 law calculates the numbers might, in sort of extreme cases, lead to differences of a couple of million dollars. But this is one of the reasons why I've provided you with the data at the bottom of this sheet that says amount paid, and these are the amounts that were paid in amounts that were paid in inheritance tax under current law between 2002 and 2007, and you can see the variation. I mean, it goes everywhere from $44 million up to $100 million, and we've been using on average a $200 million per biennium, but that number shifts around a lot, and to some degree, the amount of natural resource credit gets kind of lost in the noise, and of course, I would ultimately defer to staff on the question of the way that this calculates out, but part of, I think, the work group's rationale on the recommendations as far as the ratio was concerned here was that it was going to be very hard to separate out in some ways the effect of the credit versus the overall variation in what the inheritance tax amounts looked like.
We'll talk about this more.
Yeah. The only thing that I would note about what you've described is that we've added a new cliff, and that's at $15 million for natural resources, property estates with natural resources in them. The way we calculated the tax under the law currently in effect, the maximum amount that you could claim would actually come at about the midpoint, and then it would decline from there in estate size, and then it would decline from there until it got to zero at $15 million. The way you've calculated it, it continues to go up until it hits 14 plus, and then it drops to zero. So we may not care about that cliff as much as we do about the one that we currently have at $1 million for all estates, but it's there under this proposal, I think.
Co-Chair Barnhart, I would point out that's true if you look at the way that the schedule is set out under existing law, but one of the results of the fact, it's modified by the fact that you never had to claim the full amount of natural resource property. So if you had a $15 million or a $14.9 million estate and $14 million in natural resource property, it never would have made sense under current law to claim more than $7.5 million for the exact reason that you just pointed out. Right. And so as a practical matter, if you looked at the way that the estates would have been distributed, although we never had estates that were that large, but if we would have looked at this over a long period of time, it probably still would have shown effectively what amounted to a cliff in the sense that nobody ever would have claimed more than $7.5 million in natural resources.
This is the reason we have experts working on it instead of having me do it. No, this example is completely obvious to you, had never occurred to me.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, please.
When we built this, just to be historically accurate here, when we built this with going up to $7.5 million and then coming down, there was an insistence on doing this to avoid the cliff. Yeah. You remember the discussion about the cliff is going to destroy everybody. But then once we built that, the last amendment that we had in the bill said, okay, we'll allow for partial election of what you can the credit. And once you allowed for partial election, that whole thing coming down didn't matter anymore.
Just
because you could partially elect the highest level of. So all the work that we've done to do this transition, because it was insistent and everybody said, you have to be locked in, all of a sudden, with the one amendment of partial election, went away. So that's what we ended up with.
Thank you. I do appreciate the explanation. All right.
Co-Chair Barnhart and Co-Chair Berger will go back to the...
Okay, we're back.
So now we're having finished up number 5B on page 10, we're moving now on to 5C on page 11 of the report. Similar to federal and state marital deductions overlap issues, this section of the report explains that you can make a natural resource property election on the same property that you've made a federal marital deduction. Under existing law, the federal tax is so high that people do pass the property to their spouse to defer their federal taxes because that rate is so high. It used to be 45%. So the problem was then when you did your state tax return, you couldn't take a natural resource property election because you made an election on your spousal. And so this says, you know, you can do what you need to do for your federal and you can do what you need to do for your state so that it's not just the second spouse who can take advantage of the natural resource property, that it's both because you can make different elections. So that's codified at the bottom of page 5, at the top of page 6, making it clear that an executor can claim both.
Of the bill.
Of the dash 5, right. It's on page 5. The bottom of page 5 under the top of page 6. Yep. It makes it clear that an executor may make separate elections for state tax purposes. And it's listing all the federal provisions, but those
this,
are...
So this becomes flexibility for the estate.
Yes.
And full employment for estate administration, lawyers, and accountants.
Job creation.
Yes, job creation. Right.
Job creation. Did you just say that?
I did say that,
good.
Yes.
All right.
Oh, it's a job.
No,
it's a jobs bill.
It's a job bill.
I'm just validating.
Actually, I was simply responding to what your suggestion was. But it does appear that it does that, doesn't it?
Actually, Mr. Chair, if I may, with the increase of the threshold to $1.5 million, and you've got bills like up in Judiciary Committee to allow another law commission bill that allows for transfer of real property by a transfer on death deed to avoid probate, I'm afraid we're probably undercutting the estate planning business here by what we're doing between a combination of these bills.
And would real property passing at death under that deed become part of an estate?
It still would be subject to tax. Yes, that's correct.
Thank you.
Well, I think it'd still be job creation, Mr. Chair. Remember, the higher states, the ones that have higher tax now, are the ones who can afford the lawyers and the. So therefore, you would be pushing them a lot more because you have higher.
And they can bill more.
Now,
of course,
we've been saying these things semi tongue in cheek. The reality is that I think it's your view, and tell me if I've got it wrong, that passing a bill like this actually reduces ambiguities in our system and makes the assurance of what the plan is more real.
No question.
And probably, overall, decreases costs of administration.
Mr. Chair, I think that is exactly right.
Yeah, thank you.
Co-Chair Barnhart and Co-Chair Berger, back to the report. Letter D on page 11 is working capital, change to operating allowance. I think we've talked about this before, but I'll show you the chapter and verse this time. On page 13 of the dash 5, you'll see that lines 6 and 7 are repealed, and that was the provision that provided a credit for working capital. And instead, on page 16 of the bill, as I explained before on line 6, operating allowance is included within natural resource property. And then on lines 9 through 12, we define what operating allowance means. In existing law, working capital is defined by administrative rule. This puts it in the statute. There's been some disagreement about what working capital meant as defined by administrative rule, and so we thought it was an important concept to define, and it's probably what you might think it is. It's cash or cash equivalent that is spent, maintained, used, or available for the operation of those old definitions that we've, those new ones, farm business, forestry business, or fishing business.
And not spent or used for any other purpose.
Right. So you can't just have your personal bank account. This has to be separated for the farm, forestry, or fishing business. We'll talk about disposition in a little bit, but this is the new definition, and that it is included within natural resource property, that definition, and it does repeal working capital. Turning now to page 12, the work group discussed this working capital operating allowance issue at great length and knew that there were concerns about abuse of electing cash. And so we put in a few safeguards to assure that within people just claiming cash to defer their estate tax, and that it would be used for the business or such. So three things we've done is that by including the definition of, including in the definition of natural resource property operating allowance, we've allowed, we have it subject to the same disposition rules. In other words, if you don't use it for the business, then you're going to have to pay a tax at when that disposition occurs. So if you have elected $1 million as cash, and then within 5 years you pass it on to another heir or you go on a trip to Maui, you're going to have to pay tax on that proportion to how many years that you didn't keep it in use. So it's going to have the same 5 years out of 8 years restriction. That's not an existing law for working capital. We're not sure that that was intentional or not to not restrict it, but we think that that's in keeping is the right policy. If you're going to claim a credit for property because it's part of your natural resource property, then you need to use it for the natural resource property. You shouldn't be able to just claim it and then 2 days later turn around and use it for something else. So it's putting that same disposition restriction on it.
I think what you've discovered is one of the reasons why making changes piecemeal is dangerous.
Thank you. Second,
Representative Brewer?
I'm going to defer because she may address it.
Thank you.
Secondly, we have put that 20% or $1.5 million restriction, so you can't claim an unlimited amount of cash. We think what's important is the business in terms of real property and personal property to run that forest, farm, or fishing business. So there are some limits. We think it's self-policing, though, because of the disposition issue, that if you're going to elect on cash or cash equivalents, you're locking it up for 5 out of 8 years. So, and you have to actually have it. A lot of these farm, forestry, and fishing businesses are operating on debt, and so they're not going to have an excess amount of cash. But if they do, the locking it up for that 5 out of 8 years is a self-policing in effect. And thirdly, we're requiring a tracking of what you claim. Presently, there's no form, if you will, that has to be updated. You elect on a number, but there's not a specification in current law. The department has some flexibility with rulemaking, but this law, as the Dash 5s are written, the executor has to specify what property they're claiming for this credit, and then after that it passes to the heir that has that property. It's their responsibility then to file an annual report tracking. So, for example, if they claimed 40-acre property, on the annual report they have to note whether they're still using it for the farm or if they've transferred it or replaced it. There'll be a notation, and if there's been a disposition, then there would be a tax due. So it's same for this capital as well. They'd have to note where that cash has been tracked.
Thank you. That is exactly what my question was about. So the onus of the 5-year reporting period and the tracking, the annual reports, is based on the no longer beneficiary, but the, what was the term?
Principal
distributee. So they have the onus on it. What if they don't file, or what if they dispose of the property and have converted it into non-natural resource property? we still have the super lien rights that are heading towards the replacement. I mean, what happens? What's the recourse? How does that work then?
Chair Barnhart, Representative Brewer, I'd have to defer to the department on the details of it, but it is a tax that is imposed, and we've actually put in a due date. Present law does suggest that if there's a disposition, there's additional tax due, but it doesn't have enough of the procedure of when that tax becomes due, and we've put that in that it's 6 months after disposition. And so it's a tax imposed just like the estate tax that has the full authority of the department to enforce it.
This is more of a comment. From a practitioner's perspective, I find that I like the idea of the reporting requirement. I find it problematic because we put it into the heir's hands to report, and it could be multiple. They could have a business manager. I mean, we're talking various levels of sophistication in that 5-year reporting. Good in theory, problematic in practicality and implementation. And I'd be concerned that it is either, one, not going to be complied with, perhaps unwittingly or wittingly, and two, that the ability to audit or capture the accurate information on it, particularly when we have operating assets of this natural resource company. I mean, how do you can take the tractor and sell it, I saw in your report, and convert it into another property. Gosh, the tracing is going to be enormous on it. It seems rather impractical to me to follow that and track it, and probably that particular area of compliance needs some work. Just the reality of life meeting there.
Any thoughts on that comment?
Co-Chair Barnhart, Representative Brewer, the problem of enforcement is one that came up repeatedly throughout the work group, and we certainly recognize the problem. I think that on this particular issue, the theory was, it's at least hopefully going to be better than would have been true under existing law. That said, you're absolutely right that the problem of enforcement is one that is ever present, and that it was very helpful to have the department in the work group and participating in the work group to help kind of remind us of that problem throughout. I don't know that we have any magical solutions to the problems that you point out. You're right that they are issues that need to be addressed, but the best that we could do is create a structure that was at least hopefully relatively straightforward to understand and that the department can then work with going forward on problems of enforcement.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Brewer, I think we've done about the best job we can with this, and I appreciate the concern about, this heir's responsibility to file the report. In my mind, I see that really as just another obligation that comes with the running of the business that you've inherited from the estate. You're going to have to pay the property taxes. You're going to have to pay income taxes on the operation. And, one more thing, this came to you through a natural resource credit property, and so as a result of that, annually you've got to file a report to show that you're still using it in the operation of a farm, fishing, or forestry business, and that's just one of the things you do as a responsibility of the business. So I don't know who else to put that burden on. It wouldn't be the executor at that point. The executor is removed from the picture, and currently we don't have any reporting requirements. So it's up to the farmer across the road to call the department and say that, did you know they sold the farm? We think this is a smidge better than that.
That works well.
So I see this as just being one more obligation that. That heir has as an aspect of operating the farm that they've inherited, and I think it's workable. It's not perfect, but it's workable.
And the department could set up a tally system, couldn't it, when an estate claims this mechanism to look for a report for the next 5 years?
I think so.
And if it didn't get it, to inquire?
Ask, yeah.
Chair Barnhart, Representative Brewer, if I might also add, on page 21, starting on lines 8, existing law of the dash 5s, so page 21, line 8, existing law says that if an executor is going to make this election for the credit, they have to notify the transferee. So they have to notify the heir they're going to make that election and notify them that with this comes a responsibility that additional tax may come due. So that, and you have to, there has to be written acknowledgement of that notice on your tax return. So the department will have a list of what heirs are receiving property for which the executor is making an election.
So then it's that name is the one who's then now in the new sub 10, starting on lines 15. It's that transferee, that heir, who has to do the annual report. Now, if they transfer it to another relative who, you know, that's one of the requirements, it has to be going to a relative, that is permissible and wouldn't cause a disposition, but then, again, you have to file and make the election and note it, whether it falls in one of these categories of on lines 24 through 29, whether it's still in the operation, whether it's been replaced, but it meets the requirements, or whether there's been a disposition intact. So as Lane has explained, we really felt like we needed some sort of tracking, and this was the best way to try to do that and give the department some sort of tools to keep track of this property that's been claimed for credit.
Thank you.
Okay, so we're now moving on to replacement property, which is on the bottom of page 12 of the report. It's on page 20 of the dash 5. Committee, this was an interesting area because there's really nothing in existing law about replacement property, and we're not sure that just wasn't discussed or what happened there. Originally, this area of law seems to be focused on real property, and so maybe replacement wasn't a thought in that area of, you know, you just keep that real property. But existing law covers personal property as well as working capital, and so it just doesn't seem to work as well to not allow any kind of replacement. And things break down, things aren't durable like real property is, and so we needed to address that area of, well, what happens when property you claimed has to be replaced sometime in that 5 out of 8 years. And so This bill addresses that and says that's not going to cause a disposition with additional tax if you, what you're replacing the claim property with is also natural resource property. So in the report, as Representative Brewer mentioned, if the tractor breaks down and you have to replace it, as long as you're using the value, if you're, you know, selling it or whatever, you're replacing it with something else that's still part of that business, it's not going to cause a disposition. We were concerned, though, about claiming, you know, $1 million of cash, and then, or actually, we're more concerned about the real property that you had 40 acres, and then you convert that to cash, and then just keep the cash. We thought this area was really meant to protect the land base, and so this bill says that you can replace property with other natural resource property, except if you claimed real property, you can't replace that with something else. It has to be real property. You can replace real property for real property, but we're not going to be switching it out for cash or personal property.
Interestingly, that you're hitting things that were apparently not drafted well in the earlier bills, but were certainly part of our thinking when we wrote them.
Sure.
So you have captured what we thought we were doing.
So that's on page 20, lines 22 through 27, saying that real property has to be replaced with real property. We also addressed this issue of what if you, the farm is moving along and they were in the middle of a sale or something. The present law seems to really be tied to at the date of death. You had to have it, and then you claim it, but it takes a while to file your return and such. So on page 17, we deal with the issue of prior to claiming the credit, that little window. The same thing, you're allowed to replace property as long as it's not real property. Real property has to be replaced with other real property. And again, as I explained earlier in discussion with Representative Brewer, you have to track this replacement property if you elected it, and you can replace it, but you need to be noting that on your annual report that it falls into that category.
So if you're in the middle of a land swap at the time of the death, you can continue that.
Yep.
And yeah, okay.
Then there's the look forward requirement. This is on page 13 of the report, letter F. This bill treats all property the same. In other words, that 5 out of 8 years would apply to all real property, personal property, as well as the operating allowance. Present law seems to only look at that real property instead of the whole thing. And as I explained, I think that was the intent. Then G is the look back requirement. We've changed that look back a bit to require 5 years out of 8 years before the decedent's death of operating a business, one of these farm, forestry, or fishing business. So it's a business requirement look back, so you can't on your deathbed start the farm or whatever that you hadn't been operating, but you maybe you had property but you never operated a business. So we think that's more of the intent of a look back, is to have a business for that length of time, but wanting to keep some of the same concepts. But real property, you couldn't claim real property unless you'd had that real property for 5 years. Again, it didn't make sense to require 5 out of 8 years before death to have had the personal property or the cash on hand.
Or the chickens.
Exactly. That was my example. That'd be one nasty chicken, 5 years. We don't think that was the intent. But real property, we kept that look back that you needed to have the property for 5 years. So I think the point was we didn't want land grabs to expand a business on the deathbed. But we didn't see land or chicken grabs as being such a much of a problem. But the real property, there is a look-back requirement that you can't claim it unless you've had it for at least 5 years. The problem, again, though, was we saw a couple of issues. One, the exchange situation, that maybe you've been farming for a long time, 20 years or something, but recently switched properties with another relative or something. This would allow tacking of to get that 5 years if it was a like-kind exchange, or if there'd been an involuntary conversion, you could use some tacking rules to get the 5 years. But otherwise, you'd have to have property for 5 years to be able to claim it for the credit.
Well, when you mentioned chickens, it got me thinking about inventory. How do you handle inventory? In different farming businesses, this is a different kind of thing. I may have wheat in my elevator because the price is too low and I can't sell it. Mm-hmm. I may have wine in the cellar that isn't ready to sell, even though it may be 2 or 3 years old. How do you deal with the... And I may have a chicken that is a couple of years old and it shouldn't be allowed to get much older.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, that all those types of things would be included under the personal property descriptions of natural resource property. I remember there's frozen or stored or something like that. It does include the inventory.
Thank you. Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The ownership requirement of 5 out of the last 8 years, does it require ownership and use in the natural resource, or does it just require ownership?
Co-Chair Barnhart, Co-Chair Berger, represented by our, I believe it covers both. It's supposed to be used in the operation, because that's otherwise it wouldn't meet the definition of natural resource property.
So owned and used.
That's right.
Correct.
Okay.
End of the definition.
Mm-hmm. Co-Chair Barnhart, Representative Brewer, on page 18 of the dash fives, lines 2 through 6 is the relevant language. The credit's allowed only if the real property was owned by the decedent during the aggregate period of 5 to 8 years and used in a business described in subsection 3D.
Okay. And used. Thank you.
Right, and the way this is set up, if I understand it, you don't include the amount of a crop that's encumbered by a crop loan in the value of the estate, and you don't include it in this definition of natural resources property either. I mean, many farmers borrow money in the late winter or early spring in order to get their crop in and pay the bank back when they harvest.
Mr. Chair, I think the answer to that is that's still part of the estate, but you do have deductions for the debt.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, so it's in the estate, but then you back that out when you've got debt owing against it.
So it comes off of the gross estate.
Yes, that's right.
For the federal estate.
Yes, and we incorporate definition. That by references to the federal taxable estate.
Clint is giving me a nod, so he agrees.
Members of the committee, moving on. Page 14, fishing business qualifications.
Anybody have any questions about that?
Yeah. Basically, you made this the same as the farms and forestry. You've got to have the right stuff for 5 years, basically. We really couldn't find a lobbyist to help us make sure we've got all that covered right. There just aren't the same number of fishing folks these days. All right.
right. And then the last on I is the accountability and disposition. I think I've explained that a lot. We've really defined what has to happen for there to be an additional tax when you haven't met your 5 years. We've required the tracking provisions and the annual report. So we've just really tightened that up. And then lastly, on page 16, we've addressed a couple of interest issues to stop escalated interest when you've gotten an extension because you do have collateral or bond. And then on the other side, we've dropped the interest that the state has to pay on a refund when the taxpayer hasn't actually filed or they've overpaid and we don't have a return. So we're getting rid of this effect of the Department of Revenue being the bank while the taxpayer gets their filing done. So on both accounts, we're following the federal law for interest rate policy. So that takes us through all of the policy changes. Oh, excuse me, there's one more on page 17. There's a couple of Department of Revenue fixes. One is we codify a statute of limitations. Two, we put the due date in statute for when your return is due. And third, we state in the law that you have to substantiate how your values were arrived at for determining the value of the estate. This is done in practice that you attach your appraisal as you do on the federal return. It just doesn't say that in statute right now. And this just will help those disputes on how to value that you are to substantiate that value. So those are just some cleanups to help the department. And lastly, what's not in the bill but what is in the report on page 17, number 7, is that we do recommend increasing just the support that the department has for estate tax returns. It's a very small department presently, and if it is...
Very small section.
That we do just recommend perhaps that could be beefed up to increase compliance and just to assist the department, especially as these new changes are implemented.
You have Representative Brewer.
Thank you. Just to that point, I had an observation in having the pleasure and privilege of sitting on the Subways and Means General Government of where the Department of Revenue came forward, and just had this conversation with Department of Revenue yesterday, wondering and they're actually going to do some business analysis on this, on adding to this area inside. What triggered my thought on it is when I saw the report on the amnesty dollars that I believe there were 16 estates that filed under the amnesty program, and there was quite a large number of tax dollars that came through. And I think when we went from a pickup state based on federal, I mean, we had some estates that just kind of fell into an abyss. And when we have that many, that much dollars coming in under an amnesty program, it tells me that there's money left on the table.
Yeah.
A little bit different than just auditing. Auditing can be rather reactive just based on returns filed, but looking at perhaps unreported revenue, unwittingly, perhaps in many cases, and looking at that I concur with this based on what I've observed, and I know that they're actively looking at that as a department to see, from a business perspective, adding more cost, what's the return on that investment to the state?
I might also find out that demographically there will be more estates, period. We're getting older.
Could have gone all day without saying that.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Brewer, that was also one of the reasons, I don't know if we touched on it today, but that was in part our thinking on raising that threshold to $1.5 million. We think that there, are estates that go unfiled and unreported, small estate, in the scheme of things, in many cases because people may be unrepresented and may just not know. As you get to that, we thought that, there's more likelihood that someone with $1.5 million or a married couple with $3 million, because that's really what it comes down to there, they're going to be more likely to be connecting with attorneys and tax practitioners to do the planning. And we think that we're probably more likely to get compliance for the estates that really have to file with that $1.5 million than we might be getting right now with $1 million. If someone gets a large insurance settlement, life insurance settlement, it just may not occur to them that they just got a taxable estate. Mom never lived like she was rich, that kind of thing. But by raising that to $1.5 million, we think that we're probably getting now more into a more sophisticated level of estates who are more likely to be informed of the obligation. And so in that way, we hope that we'll increase compliance as well. Mr. Chair, I'm sorry.
I was going to say, none of that, what I just said, though, should be construed that I agree or disagree with the estate tax. I just want, if we've got it.
Yes, right.
Yeah. Yeah,
let me say that the point of this bill never gets to the question of whether we ought to have one or not.
Exactly. Right.
What it gets to is fixing the one we've got.
Exactly.
And I think that's important as we work on this, that we understand that that's what the point of the conversation is. I wanted to simply note, Representative Brewer, that I'm very pleased that you're working on that subcommittee. One of the discussions that we've been having before you got here for a long time is when we're being penny wise and pound foolish by not spending more money in the Department of Revenue, where it could be used to generate substantially more than the amount we're spending. Mm-hmm. And so I'm very glad to hear that you're on that one and that you're going to represent the interest of raising revenue through compliance.
Through compliance, not taxing.
Not through changes in the tax system, but simply by getting more people to pay the taxes that they already owe.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Thank you. Several of us have been very silent, and that's fine, but if there are any other questions for the panel, now would be a good time.
Time for comments?
Yes, please, Representative Berger.
Thank you. Okay, I have sat on this committee for a lot of years. This has been an area that was unworkable, unknowable, and then we added the resource piece to it and made it just totally untenable. And finally, we are back to a cogent system that even I can understand. And this is certainly not my area of expertise, but I can see the questions have been asked and answered so that as practitioners and folks work their way through this, the questions that come up, there will be a statutory answer and a regulatory mm-hmm. answer, and we can move forward. I think the co-chair's point is a good one. We're not asking whether we should have an estate tax, but if we're going to have one, let's have one that works and is understandable, and without you, we weren't there. And I know this has been a huge burden and a lot of work for a lot of folks who aren't paid to do this. They do this because they love the state and because this is important work. And even though the front page of the Oregonian won't say Law Commission fixes mess, those of us in this room would like it to say that. So thank you.
Yes.
Thank you, Co-Chair. It's been a pleasure to work on this. I know we're not done, but I can see the finish line. We do have the brains of the organization behind us, and I know Representative Ruhr would like an answer to her question about a permissible distributee. Jeff Sheen might be able to offer that. And Mr. Chair, with your permission, I might just invite other members of the work group to come forward.
Please.
And offer their thoughts on this as well. Thank you.
That would be great. Thank you. Yeah, go ahead and pass it around. Yeah. And colleagues, we're going to take about another 15 minutes if we need them on this one, this work session. And then we have another one which we think will only take a few minutes.
Thank you.
Gentlemen.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Representative Barnhart, Representative Berger, and Representative Brewer, on the question of the...
Jen?
I'm Jeff Sheen.
Yes, thank you.
I'm an attorney from Portland. On the question of the permissible distributee, and I think there's also a term in the qualified beneficiary, when we were drafting the Oregon special marital property provisions, we used the term beneficiary. But the problem that sort of created as we started looking at it is who's a beneficiary and who's not a beneficiary, because most of the time when you have a beneficiary designation, you'll have a current beneficiary and you'll have contingent beneficiaries, and then you'll have contingent beneficiaries. And as you read that, the current section in the Oregon Special Marital Property, there's no cutoff on how far down the line you have to go for getting consent. So what we've done with permissible distributee is to borrow from the Oregon Uniform Trust Code, which became effective in 2006 after the Oregon Special Marital Property Bill had been passed. So now permissible distributee is a definitional concept from the trust code that says you look to who the current beneficiary is and who would be the beneficiary if the current beneficiary didn't exist, and you stop there. So it kind of puts an identification tag, if you will, on who a beneficiary is that has to sign off consenting to the election. So we thought we'd borrow from a statute. So, and then qualified beneficiary, which I think appears in the natural resource area, is kind of the same thing. It's a definition that we're borrowing from the Oregon Trust Code to help define the scope of what constitutes a beneficiary.
Thank you.
That help?
Yeah, very much so.
Thank you.
So, Chair Barnhart, Co-Chairs Barnhart and Berger, and the members of the committee, I'm Clint Bentz, and I'm a tax practitioner. I'm a CPA, a partner of the accounting firm Bolt Carlisle Smith. And as a practitioner, there were several things in this bill that are really important, and it's why I dedicated a lot of volunteer time to getting this across the finish line, and I'm really hoping we can get there. The first one is this idea of going from the million to a million and a half and going from a filing requirement to an exclusion. So right now you owe a tax on the first dollar. You just don't have to pay the tax until you have over $1 million. And so you have $1,001,000, and now all of a sudden you owe tax on the entire thing because now you have to file. And so to go from, and that was really hard to explain to my clients. because the federal law is not that way. And everybody talks about this exclusion, but it's not. It's just the filing requirement. And so now saying we're going to exclude the first million and a half the same way the feds exclude now 5 million is much easier to explain. And, in fact, now we're looking, so we have the state over that. Now we start how much tax is on the amount over. It's a very important concept that this law gives us, which we've needed for a long time. So that's a great fix. Changing the tie-in, you know, right now the tie-in is to December 31st, 2000. I don't have a code book that has 2000 on it, but I know that the code books exist because they're down at the Department of Revenue. They, in fact, have the 2000 code book down there. And you know, if we want to know what it is, I've got to go down and find out because I can't even get access to it anymore. So updating the code, and there's been a lot of changes to the federal definitional stuff, so that's really important, is changing the tie-in. We were really happy right at the 11th hour as we were getting done that the feds actually gave us a law that we could tie to, and we realized that as we're going through this, the challenge of being tied to a federal system that's in such a state of flux. But getting to the 2010 code is really important. The working capital deal, and who I was a part of, you know, trying to negotiate the first one, and it was a great idea that was completely unworkable in practice. How do we figure out how much working capital? And so I was involved legislatively. I was involved in the rulemaking. We finally came to this, and we came to the Goldilocks solution of, you know, 20% is just about right. And so we came up with a number and said, okay, it's 20%. It's easy to figure. It's 20% of all the natural resource property, not counting the cash amount. And I think in addition to the kind of the side rails that we put on this in the law, the real side rail on these natural resource estates is that you have non-farm heirs who, if there's any cash, want it. And so to stick any amount of cash aside for the business is a challenge. And so if we can, in fact, stick some cash aside for the business, that's a great thing, and put it there. And then to be able to use it for anything that we want to in the business. So we want to buy a combine or put it in the ground and crops, or we haven't put any rails around it, we can use it for the business. But if we pull it out, then it gets taxed. I think that's a great concept. The replacement rule for property, we spent a lot of time working on this and decided we need to drag in all the 1031 language. And I think we really landed well on that, where on the look back, we're saying you have to have owned this property for 5 years, and if you traded it through a 1031 exchange, you can get taxing. But going forward, if you don't otherwise have to do a 1031 exchange, we're not going to require you to do a 1031 exchange. But if you sell the property, you do have to replace it within 12 months. So you can do a cash sale and replace it without going through 1031. I think that's a great part of the law. The tracking rules, we talked a long time about this, realizing that there are two people in the Department of Revenue right now in this, in the estate section, that we didn't want to create work for five more people to administer this law. The heirs who get this property have to sign off that to accept the responsibility, and that's part of the decision that, that the estate makes and the executor makes. Do we, and a lot of estates choose not to do the natural resource property because they don't want to tie up the property for 5 years. We're adding this additional requirement that they also, there is going to be a list of assets that's attached to the return. These are the specific assets that we claim the natural resource property on. So the first list is there. That list will go to the heirs. They're going to have to, in their accounting, figure, okay, if I sold this one, what did I replace it with, and report that back. I think that's a reasonable thing that everybody's going to have to sign up for before they get the credit in the first place. So I don't think that that's an unreasonable burden, and it does really significantly reduce the compliance requirements for the department. So we like that.
And the way you've done it, it only takes a couple hours a year.
It shouldn't be that bad.
Yeah.
I mean, it's going to be hard, but people...
No.
But we also didn't say you have to replace a combine with a combine.
Right.
As long as you keep the money in the business, you know, that's the issue.
Mr. Benz, Mr. Chair. Mr. Yes. Benz, may I remind you of the tracing rules?
Oh, I know.
And debt tracing rules, and does it take more than a few minutes?
Yeah.
Exactly. And that's what we're looking, because we do allow operational cash, and we do allow personal property in this to actually be converted to cash and replaced. And we also do allow a 1 or 2 year, depending on sale, disposition of real property and how that is, that we actually are now asking us to trace cash. And that is a little bit more than a few minutes. It can become quite a burden to someone who's unsophisticated. But you're right. They sign on for it to get the property and to get the credit.
Mm-hmm.
So...
Thank you. Finally, I just, you know, I think it was important to say the charge of the committee, the working group, was kind of to say, to look at two things. We wanted to look at the natural resource credit, but also the bill as a whole. When we did look around and saw that there's only two Western states that, in fact, have an estate tax, it did beg the question, why does Oregon have one? We felt it was outside the scope of the charge given to this committee to opine on that, but it is, I think, a question that ought to be addressed. And in fact, our tax was bigger than our neighboring state of Washington. So we do, I think, an issue that came up with the department, and this will be another thing that we fixed was there was a real question whether or not, in fact, we had a filing requirement under the existing law based on the language. So we did fix that. We do have to file. But, you know, whether or not there was a true filing requirement, the real issue is the department was relying completely on the federal for all the compliance, the federal audit function. And so as that number diverged and it was a $3.5 million, there was a gap. But now at $5 million, there's a huge gap. I think I look at the numbers nationally. I think they're expecting like 5,000 estates nationally a year under the $5 million. So it's a pretty small number. And so basically, I imagine in Oregon, you know, if we have one or two estates a year that actually get audited by the feds, that's going to be a big number. And so the compliance, the real thing, this is a voluntary tax because nobody's looking. And we don't want to say that out loud, but I just did.
Representative Brewer will take care of that.
And so the compliance issue is really important, and it needs to be addressed. Because ultimately what this becomes is it's a tax on using professionals. So if somebody comes to us, if somebody doesn't come and see me, then, that's a problem. So thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes, Mr.
Sheen. I have a couple more comments, and then I'll conclude. We really appreciate the change in the intangible personal property, because, when we walked through that process under current Oregon law, it was like it was kind of a convoluted test, as if you, as a resident of Oregon, you look to the state where the property is, and if they wouldn't tax an Oregon residence, then it's not taxable. And you get into these issues with, well, Hawaii, for example, has a statute that says we won't tax yours if you don't tax ours. But nobody says don't tax ours. So it really does simplify a lot of that process. Representative Brewer, given what you're looking at, one issue that we talked about, and we didn't put it in the bill, but on a federal income tax return, there's a question that all taxpayers have to sign off on whether they have foreign bank accounts or not under penalty of perjury. And we did kick around, and I don't know that we necessarily got to a point of recommending it for this bill, but the Oregon income tax return could have a question. If this is a final return, do you have a Oregon inheritance tax or estate tax return to file? So, mm-hmm. as a means of kind of triggering compliance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That is good because we already have on Oregon about to file Form 24 on there, which is another kind of unique outlier type situation. And to add that, I'm sure Department of Revenue would have some input, but that might be a good way to go.
Thank you.
And then in closing, I would like to thank this committee for referring this whole package to the Oregon Law Commission and Representative Berger, because, I mean, Clint and I have sat with a number of you in work sessions trying to deal with working capital while the legislature is in session. And that's pretty difficult. So this kind of year-and-a-half process kind of gave us time to work that out. So
great.
Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. Other questions? I'd just simply like to add to the comments that other people have made that while the state paid a small amount of money to help defray some of the costs of the work, the fact is that the vast, vast bulk of the cost was absorbed by the volunteers, the members of the commission, and the other volunteers who helped out, including the two of you. I simply want to note that a state like Oregon could not afford to pay for the kind of work that you and the commission have done for us here. I gestured to Representative Berger a moment ago because when we were frustrated as could be, I think in 2009, about how to deal with the natural resources estate tax issues, her suggestion was that we refer it to the commission. I think it was a very good decision on our part to have done so, and we really appreciate all the work that you've done. And, of course, we're not finished with this bill. We're going to have at least another work session on it to make sure that the committee's comfortable, and we may have additional questions for you. But I really like the fact that all the questions that we came up with today, you had some sort of an answer for, and while we may or may not have all been completely pleased about the answers, it was easy to track your thinking and where how you got there, and the trade-offs that were involved in that. So, for me personally, I want to thank you and the commission and the other volunteers for the work that you've done. We appreciate it very, very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Anything else? Why don't we hold that till our next session? There's some discussion items. Please review for our next session. And I want to close this work session so we can get to the other one this morning. Anything else on this one for now? All right. With that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2541 and open a work session on House Bill 2476. And who's on that one? Oh, okay, good. Good morning.
Good morning. Co-Chair Barnhart, Co-Chair Berger, members of the committee. House Bill 2476 would remove the explicit requirement that county assessors seek the review of a county board of review for income approach factors used to value farmland. The fiscal impact statement has come back. It's a minimal expenditure impact, and there's finding of no revenue impact on this measure. A number of issues can come up with some assessors utilize the board of review process, but there can be a difficulty in finding members to sit on the board at times. Many of the farm use values are based on rents, and assessors may or may not use the farm board to arrive at these rents. The measure has been recommended by the Government Efficiency Task Force, and this was one of the recommendations of the task force.
Thank you. What's your pleasure, Representative Berger?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2476 to the floor with a due pass recommendation from this committee.
Representative Berger moves House Bill 2476 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Berger.
I do this, Mr. Chair, with a little bit of regret. There has been some talk that one of the reasons that these farm boards are not being filled is because of the requirements of all the ethics reporting that volunteers have to go through, which is really an unfortunate thing, because these have been sort of folks who've worked in the weeds of, they don't have a lot of power, they look at something in government, and that's unfortunate. But it's also, I think, reached a point where there's not enough people to even justify the work of trying to keep these boards operational, and so it's time to move on.
Yes, it appears to be. Other discussion? Is there any objection to the motion? All right, seeing none, the motion carries. Those who are not here are excused. And with that, we'll close. The carrier. We'll ask Representative Nathanson if she'd like to carry. She's not here today to ask, but we'll ask her. And with that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2476. And we've exhausted our agenda for today. I would simply note, colleagues, please do review the material on 2541. And if you have questions, additional issues to raise, please raise them with Representative Berger or myself or committee staff, so that when we get to the next work session, we can discuss them. Representative Berger.
And I would say that Wendy Johnson, I know, is quite willing to sit down and go through the report and the thing with anyone who would like to. She has been in my office going line by line, and she will. You will get a good inkling of the thinking of the committee if you talk to her.
Right. Thank you. And with that, the committee is adjourned.